Good evening. Welcome behind the news for September 21st, 2006. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. And in about 5 or 7 minutes, we'll be listening to an interview I recorded yesterday with Lisa Jervis and Andy Zeisler, who are the editors of a collection called Bitch Fest, a collection of articles for the magazine that they were involved with for many years called Bitch, Feminist Responses to Pop Culture. And we'll talk to them about feminism and pop culture and the meaning of the word bitch. And then at the bottom of the hour, we'll have in the studio Nomi Prinz, who I just learned will be on Hugh's show next week, but we got her first. She'll be talking about her new book, Jacked, How Conservatives Are Picking Your Pocket, Whether You Voted For Them or Not, which is just out from Polypoint Press. And before we get to the bitch interview, a few words of the economic headlines. First of all, the Federal Open Market Committee, the policy-setting instrument or institution in the Federal Reserve Board, meeting earlier this week, decided to leave interest rates unchanged. The short-term interest rate under its most direct control, the so-called federal funds rate, which is the rate at which banks lend money to each other overnight. A very short-term interest rate that is most directly under the control of the Fed, and most other interest rates are priced off that. So their policy rate steady now for the third consecutive month. And they've the policy unchanged for two consecutive meetings, and historically, that's been about it. If they don't tighten after two consecutive meetings, that's it for their tightening jag. They had been raised interest rates at 17 consecutive previous meetings, bringing them off really, really historic lows to sort of medium level. Well, this is certainly not very high interest rates, 5.25%. But not the 1-2% interest rates we got used to early in the 2000s. And the Federal Reserve saying that the moderation in economic growth, which is certainly apparent in most of the statistics that are coming out, appears to be continuing, partly reflecting a cooling of the housing market, and certainly the housing numbers are coming in pretty weak. They do concede that inflation pressures, there at least some inflation risks remain, but with oil prices well off their highs now, and the job market slowing down and general economic growth and housing in particular slowing down, the Federal Open Market Committee, rightly, I would say, judging that inflation risks are receding, and so they see no further reason to raise interest rates. And when will they turn around and start loosening if the housing market starts seriously falling apart? And it's certainly giving some signs of seriously falling apart, but hasn't done that yet, then the Federal Reserve will almost certainly turn around and push interest rates way down again to prevent things from unraveling too badly. The Mortgage Bankers Association reporting the other day that its index of applications for new mortgages rose on the week, now three consecutive weeks. And two out of those 3 weeks, it was the new purchase index that rose. And then also two out of those 3 weeks, the refinancing index rose. And refinancing is interesting because it's what has been powering the economy in the midst of weak job and wage growth over the last several years. People have been refinancing and taking cash out of their alleged equity appreciation and spending that money when they do. And that's been one of the major sources of keeping consumption alive in what is otherwise a rather weak economy. And that, as mortgage rates have been coming down, refinancing activity picking up. That's not what the Federal Reserve is looking for, but we'll see how this all develops in the coming weeks. We better move along because time is short. The ABC News, Washington Post Consumer Comfort Index down 2 points last week after recovering pretty smartly in the previous several weeks. So consumer attitudes remain moderately moderate up to the downbeat side. So it's certainly reflecting a subpar job market. People are not exuberant. The only money they have to spend is what they borrow. Conference Board's leading indicators, which are designed to project U.S. economic activity 6 to 12 months out, falling in August and now falling two out of the last three months and four out of the last 5 months. Certainly portending a slowdown, if not an outright recession, in our future. Also, the Labor Department reporting this morning that first-time claims for unemployment insurance rose last week by 7,000. So that indicator, which has been stuck in a decent but not great and not terrible territory for the last 6 months or so, slipping higher, suggesting further slowdown in the job market in the coming months. And the job market has not been going gangbusters by any means. The Philadelphia branch of the Federal Reserve reporting that its index of manufacturing activity in the Middle Atlantic region falling sharply in the month of September, taking everyone by surprise. So the manufacturing economy had actually been doing kind of well for the last couple of months, but at least in this part of the world, that's not so true anymore. But we'll see if other indicators bear this out in the coming weeks. And then finally, the Federal Reserve also reporting earlier this week, releasing its so-called flow of funds account, which are really a very complicated and comprehensive view of the financial side of the U.S. economy, reports on what's going on with all the major sectors, household, government, business, business financial and non-financial, U.S. and its relation to the outside world. Very useful and somewhat obscure accounts, but lurking in there is the news that homeowners' equity, that is the equity that people have in their houses as a percentage of the underlying value, taking a dive in the second quarter, and they revised some of the last several years' figures. And now we learn that home equity is only 54% of total real estate value, an all-time low since they started reporting this in 1952. As recently as 2000, equity was 58% of total value, 64% in 1990, and way back in 1952, it was 80%. So people have been borrowing very heavily against the appreciated housing value, and that suggests that borrowing has been increasing much more rapidly than the house values. So that despite the greatest bull market in housing in modern times, homeowners' equity has actually declined. This is not a healthy sign if housing prices continue to roll over and start to play dead. So, consumer balance sheets eroding somewhat, not surprising, but if the housing market continues to unravel, it could get even worse. So we'll keep on top of that in the coming weeks and months. And let's take a little musical break to set up the interview with Lisa Jervis and Andy Zeisler. Not appropriately enough, an excerpt from the Bitch theme by the mid-90s girl punk band Bratmobile from their album Potty Mouth, released in 1992. And that's a setup for the following, which is an interview with Lisa Jervis and Andy Zeisler, which I recorded yesterday. They are founding editors of the magazine called Bitch, published out of Oakland, California. And a collection of essays from that magazine has just been released by Farrar Straus called Bitch Fest. They will be reading tomorrow night at Blue Stockings, which is at 172 Allen Street between Stanton and Rivington, one block south of Houston and First Avenue. That's tomorrow night, 7 p.m., and I'll reannounce that at the end of the interview. So let's listen to Lisa Jervis and Andy Zeisler. I recorded this yesterday. You say somewhere in one of the, I think it's one of the introductions to one of the chapter sections, that the word backlash makes you think of the 1980s. But where are we now? Are we still in the backlash against feminism, or have we moved beyond that?
I don't know if we're still in the backlash or if it's kind of we're in the backlash again. We are definitely experiencing a backlash against feminist progress and feminist policies. I mean, just the assault on reproductive rights alone, I think, is enough to establish this as backlash. But I also think that the popularity of people like Caitlin Flanagan and theories like hers and, you know, like we should
Let's pause a moment. I don't think Caitlin Flanagan is widely known enough and hated enough. So could you describe, please, contribute a little bit. Who is she and why is she so hateable?
Caitlin Flanagan is a regular contributor to both the Atlantic Monthly and the New Yorker. She is what I would call an old-fashioned anti-feminist or maybe a less sort of rabid Phyllis Schlafly. She really believes that a woman's place is in the home, and this despite the fact that she has a very thriving career as a writer and two nannies. And so she is just a great example of sort of backlash hypocrisy, because she really believes that feminism turns women and men into miserable creatures and makes women sort of abdicate their highest duty, which is, of course, bearing and raising children.
Well, that's, what do you think is the source of her appeal, since probably most of the people who read her are women? I don't think very many men would read her. But also, these are probably women with jobs and without two nannies. So why do people read her?
Well, I think that actually it's not just women who are reading her. I mean, she publishes a lot in The New Yorker, which, as far as I know, is not, you know, considered a women's magazine. Although, obviously, there are plenty of women in their audience. But I think her work appeals to probably women and men, because it reaffirms some things that we've been told by the culture for many years. I mean, it kind of reaffirms one strain of cultural belief about gender, which is that we don't actually need to change anything. We just need to have women remain and or return to this mode of homemaking above all. And she presents a very idealized picture of what that looks like, and I think that that's very comforting for some people, even though it doesn't really match what most people's lives are like, even when they are living that kind of life.
It helps to have your husband make buckets of money and have two nannies.
And she's also a great writer. I mean, that's sort of the meat of it, is that you can read halfway through a Caitlin Flanagan essay, or at least I have, and then at the same time you realize that it's just absolute retrograde drivel. It's so beautifully written that it does suck you in.
Bitch is now 10 years old, and that's the reason for this collection, Bitch Fest. And I imagine you had to go back and read a lot of old issues. First of all, did you have fun doing that? And second of all, what's changed over that decade?
It was totally fun to go and revisit stuff that we'd, you know, written or edited in the early years. I mean, there was a lot of stuff in there that I'd kind of forgotten about, and just it was like, you know, visiting old friends a little bit, even if some of them are embarrassing friends.
And what's happened in the last 10 years?
In Bitch, or sort of over?
Well, in Bitch, and what, as reflecting what's going on around it.
You know, sadly, not that much has changed. You know, the reason we started Bitch was to talk about the very limited ways that women are represented in pop culture, and also the disdain with which the media treats feminism. Really, those two things have not changed very much in 10 years, but there's definitely a lot more of them, because the culture itself has become more and more mediated. So we always knew that we would have our work cut out for us, and I think if anything has changed, it's that there's just so much more to talk about, and maybe some things are a little better, but some things are also quite a lot worse. For instance, there isn't, let's say, a perennial target of our ire back in 1996 was Beverly Hills 90210. So that's not on anymore, but there are 10 million really offensive reality TV shows.
That's Andy Zeisler. Lisa Jervis.
There were a lot of starlets with breast implants in 1996, but now we have The Swan and Extreme Makeover. You know, just everything is kind of that much more intense.
I have to confess that I don't watch much reality TV, so what are the gender offenses of reality TV that you're thinking of?
Well, I mean, I think there's the whole model of the dating and mating reality TV show, which started with a show like The Bachelorette, which was about a single man and the, you know, 16 to 20 women who were willing to humiliate and, I wouldn't say degrade, but yeah, humiliate themselves on national TV, all for the promise of a big diamond engagement ring to a man that they just didn't know. And so there have been a number of permutations of that show since then, and they've all sort of gotten progressively trashier. And I think the pinnacle is now a show called Flavor of Love, which involves Flavor Flav, formerly of Public Enemy, and the 16 to 20 women who are willing to humiliate themselves on national TV to be one of his, like, 8 baby mamas.
I am really leading a sheltered life. I wasn't aware of that. I noticed there is now must be from one of the earliest issues of Bitch, a 10-year-old essay about Martha Stewart. Here it is 10 years later. She's an ex-con trying to rehabilitate herself. What is it about Martha Stewart then and now? Put that through the Bitch prism.
Well, I think she's a really fascinating figure because she, it was almost like right out of the gate, she was kind of an icon because we never really had anyone like her before. I mean, we had people who were sort of doing TV shows about the domestic arts. I mean, there was Julia Child and people like that, but never someone who really exuded the kind of perfection that Martha did, and also made no secret of the fact that there was a lot of work that went into it. And I think definitely she became very quickly someone who people watched because they wanted to see some crack in her perfection. And certainly the fact that she was divorced, the media was able to make hay from that because here she was, the domestic goddess, the perfect housewife, but she wasn't a housewife because she was a single woman. And so, I mean, I think because
a very successful business tycoon.
Well, yeah.
I mean, not a housewife, but a media mogul, actually.
Exactly. But, like, she really did start she really did blur the lines between someone who was like, yeah, I'm just up at 5 a.m. and I'm feeding my chickens, and someone who, of course, had a staff of, you know, hundreds and was supposedly just ruled with an iron fist and all that. And, you know, besides Oprah, she was really that first icon. And
of course, yeah. Oprah is kind of warm and cuddly, whereas Martha is a bitch, right? So
I prefer the term ice queen for Martha, frankly.
Okay. Well, I was trying to use that as a not-so-clever segue into the title of your magazine. Some people find that objectionable for one reason or another. So why Bitch?
Well, we chose the name because when bitch is used as an insult, it means, you know, you're too opinionated, I'm threatened by you, basically. So I'm going to have to insult you for having an opinion and being smart and refusing to back down. And we really figured that if the word was hurled at women who fit that description, well, you know, we would like to rehabilitate the word and make that a compliment because we all should be opinionated and forceful about it. So that's kind of it in a nutshell. And then there's also the active verb component that kind of encompasses, like, okay, well, you know, we stand up for ourselves, we're called bitches, but then also when we make a stink about something that's really infuriating, we're bitching. And so, well, it's a noun, it's a verb, it's a magazine.
And the other, the subtitle, Feminist Responses to Pop Culture, some people find pop culture kind of a trivial thing to concern yourself with. Why such a focus on pop culture?
We really feel that pop culture is, because it's really the main conduit by which so many people form their ideas about the world, get their news, it helps form their identities.
Since our culture is so intensely mediated, you can't avoid absorbing these pop culture messages that really seek to teach us all sorts of stuff about gender and about politics and about how we're supposed to live our lives. And so looking at those messages critically is really imperative to navigating the world and enacting feminism in a lot of ways. And so if we ignore pop culture because we think it's frivolous or fluffy, we're really abandoning a whole sector by which people learn so much and absorb so much about themselves and other people and really the world around them. And we can't abdicate that as feminists. It's really important. It's also a really great hook to get young women interested in feminism because they're growing up totally steeped in this pop culture stuff. And thinking back to my own experience growing up, I knew that something was wrong with what women's magazines were telling me, but it took me a really long time to develop the language and an analysis of what that was and what was. And if we can kind of help equip people with that earlier on, I mean, I think it's really crucial just as far as, like, young people figuring out how to be okay with themselves.
That's the voice of Lisa Jervis, who is, along with Andy Zeisler, the co-editor of Bitch Fest, a collection of articles from Bitch Magazine, just published by Farrar, Straus, Giroux. There's an old controversy in the cultural critique business about how people receive popular culture. You know, the old grim Frankfurt School line is that pop culture just fills people's heads with false consciousness and poisons them into conformity. There is a sort of popular fashionable cultural studies line that people, you know, interpret things in very critical ways, and actually there's all kinds of resistance buried in their understanding of popular culture. How do you fall down in that controversy?
I feel that people definitely know what they're doing when they're creating pop culture. I just think, especially now, there's not enough room for alternative voices. There's not enough room for risk-taking because everything is about the bottom line. You don't have the sort of Norman Lear 70s TV shows that were really social critiques and taking chances with edgy subjects. Basically, you have TV executives saying, well, you know, people want to see Flavor of Love. People want to see Temptation Island. People want to see The Bachelor. And because those are the shows that fill the TVs, people do see them, and that gets the executives thinking that they should just create duplicates of those shows. It's hard for me to give the viewing public enough credit to say, well, people are constantly thinking, people are constantly critiquing. I mean, my sense is that because there's so much media that surrounds us, and that includes advertising and movies and music as well as things like television and film, people really are just sort of soaking in it. They're not necessarily picking apart different messages. Everything sort of is in aggregate. And I don't think that there is a huge amount of critique going on because the culture itself is continually dumbed down.
Ariel Levy had a book that came out a little while ago. I interviewed her for the show, and you interviewed her for the magazine about the raunch culture. And she sort of, not always openly, but seemed to be trying to bring back kind of McKinnonite 70s-ish feminism. What do you think of her critique of this, you know, the whole girls gone wild, the raunch culture, which in some circles is seen as a kind of assertiveness, a female assertiveness, and she, of course, Levy, is very critical of it. What do you think?
I really appreciate Levy's critique a great deal. I think that she did a really excellent job of being critical of that kind of culture of sexual display without negating female desire. I think that a lot of arguments that are totally, you know, we have to stop showing off our bodies for men, and the more kind of, as you say, McKinnonite views, I think they often leave out the role of desire and they just don't pay that much attention to it. But I think that Female Chauvinist Pigs, the book, did a really good job of not erasing that side of things. And I think that Levy's right on that a lot of that Girls Gone Wild stuff, it's not about agency or assertiveness or women's own pleasure. It's really about display. And it's
to what end, though? Who's the audience, and what do you suppose the women who bare their boobs for Francis, what's his name, Joe Francis?
Yeah, Joe Francis.
Why are they doing it?
They're drunk. They're drunk, and it gets them a certain momentary status of like, oh, look, I'm so cool. You know, I'm so free. I'm so, you know, liberated. And also, I'm so hot. Someone wants to see my boobs. I'm so hot. And, I mean, that's a really difficult thing to navigate because, of course, especially in our kind of hyper-mediated, celebrity-obsessed culture, and also just as part of human nature to want validation, everyone kind of wants to be reassured that other people find them attractive. I mean, I think that's kind of a universal human trait, but to get that validation by getting drunk and taking your shirt off, I think that we need a feminist critique of that. And without getting into, you know, criticizing specific women for doing that, I mean, I really, you know what, if you really want to do that, go ahead, do it. But I really would like you to think about the fact that you get a t-shirt or a hat and Joe Francis is making bank off of your body, and he's not paying you. You know, I don't really have any problem at all with women choosing to expose their bodies for any reason, but especially, you know, I mean, if you want to do sex work, if you want to be a stripper, if you want, you know, you're getting some very specific things out of that, and you're much more in control of what's going on than when you're flashing for Joe Francis's cameras. And so there are a lot of connections, I think, to be made between the Girls Gone Wild, Girls Gone Wild culture and an analysis to be made of that and of sex work from a feminist perspective. But I see a real difference between those things. And I think that it's a lot about who's controlling the image and who's making the decisions about what's going to happen. And the girls who are flashing for Girls Gone Wild are not in control of the image at all.
It almost seems as if the women who do that are sort of fighting an image of feminism, that feminism is repressive and grim, and they're going to show their power by being the opposite of that. Is that kind of a character off stage?
Well, she has a really good anecdote in the book as well about going to a talk, or it was a panel discussion where one of the panelists was the creator of the HBO show G-String Divas, and Ariel Levy talks about, I forget if it was her or another woman in the audience standing up and basically saying, like, why do this? It calls itself maybe an educational show, but it's really about exploitation and it's really about display. Why are you doing this? And the woman from HBO just, like, literally rolled her eyes and was very much, oh, that's so, you know, 70s feminist, as though that was just about the least cool thing you could possibly be. And I think that's true. That's why it's very difficult, because really no one wants to be Andrea Dworkin anymore. No one wants to be Catherine McKinnon, because we have an idea of those women as very anti-sex and very anti-female pleasure. And also,
although Dworkin could write some pretty steamy prose when she wanted to.
Yeah, but at the same ideas that people have about what their work is all about are not necessarily all that accurate.
Well, but at the same time, like, people do remember the fact that they were, for all practical purposes, aligned with the Christian right on things like censorship. And right now we're in an era where everything is really defined by irony and not caring and diffidence, not about any sort of passion. And so really the whole Girls Gone Wild culture is really about that. It's really about not caring and just sort of wanting to be cool and not wanting to take things too seriously. And what is feminism but taking things very seriously?
Let's talk in conclusion about Bitch itself, the magazine. You've, against, I think, pretty stiff odds, managed to create a pretty successful magazine, a pretty successful culture. You must have a sort of a cult following, right? People coming to see you when you're traveling around. Tell us about the world that Bitch has spawned.
Well, I don't think that Bitch has necessarily spawned anything so much as tapped into it and become a part of something. I mean, we certainly can't take responsibility for a bunch of young women being really excited about feminism and feminist analysis of pop culture. I mean, I think the fact that there were already a ton of women out there who were interested in that when we came along is really the reason for our success. Although, of course, I think we have encouraged a lot more of that. I certainly hope we have. It's been really exciting to come out and, like, meet people and hear things in person that usually, you know, we just get little notes and emails about, you know, how much people appreciate the magazine and how it's really helped them kind of develop their feminist consciousness. And hearing that in person is kind of heartwarming, to be really earnest and non-ironic. Really heartwarming in a way that, of course, you know, getting a letter about it is great too, but it's different to kind of look out at a sea of faces at a reading and to see the looks on people's faces, and it's been really awesome.
And then just give us an idea of what's in the book.
Well, the book has 54 essays, most of them culled from the past 10 years of Bitch, but there are about 4 or 5 brand new essays that were written just for the book, which we're really excited about. And basically, it covers everything from, you know, puberty to sex work to transgender identity to Martha Stewart. It really covers the gamut. And then we also have a resource section in the back that really provides some great places to look on the web or in print in order to sort of do further activist work in the realm of media reform and activism and just talking back in general.
I know I said in conclusion, but no, this really isn't conclusion. You're here talking about a book which is based on a magazine, but, you know, this is print culture. These days we're all post-print now. Do you feel... I wanted to ask you that question. You don't feel like a relic from the Gutenberg era?
No, we heart print. I mean, it's funny. no one asks us, people don't ask us this much, this question as much anymore as they used to. During the internet boom, especially, you know, we're based in the San Francisco Bay Area, we got asked it all the time, why are you even publishing a print magazine anymore? You know, because print's dead. Print's going to be dead, like, really dead in about, you know, 30 seconds. So why are you publishing it? And we just love print and the feel of it and the smell of it and the fact that you can take it on the subway and into the bathroom and all sorts of places where you can't take your computer yet. And I think that with the bursting of the bubble, it's been proven that, you know, reports of print's imminent demise were greatly exaggerated, as they say. And it's been really gratifying to continue in the print realm. And something else that people used to talk about during the boom was like, well, you really should, you know, that the internet is so much more accessible, you know, because people don't have to pay for their copy of the magazine. It's like, no, they only have to buy a $1,000 machine and pay a monthly fee for something to access the internet. There's nothing more accessible than a magazine, where anybody with $6 can walk into a bookstore and walk out with a magazine. Nothing is going to replace print in terms of accessibility, in my opinion.
And that's the voice of Lisa Jervis, who, along with Andy Zeisler, who you also heard from, are the editors of Bitch Fest, a collection of essays from the magazine they founded, Bitch Magazine. And they will be reading tomorrow at Blue Stockings, which is a bookstore everyone should patronize frequently, at 172 Allen Street between Stanton and Rivington, one block south of Houston and First Avenue. That's at 7 p.m. tomorrow. And let's take a break for station ID, and we'll be back in a little bit with Nomi Prinz.
New Orleans Jazz Vipers at WBAI, New York City.
And this is WBAI 99.5 on the FM dial and WBAI.org on the web. My name is Doug Henwood. The program is Behind the News. And let's take a little musical break to set up Nomi Prinz.
We are sick and tired of being promised this and that. We work all day, we sweat and we save to keep the world intact. Things in our heads with promises and bamboozled us with facts. And they bump false sincerity and they laugh behind our backs. Money and corruption are ruining the land. Look at politicians betraying the working man. Pockets in their bosses and treating us like sheep. We're tired of fearing politics and all the never be. Money and corruption ruining the land. Look at politicians betraying the working man. Pockets in their bosses and treating us like sheep. We're tired of fearing politics.
And that bit of the Kinks, Money and Corruption, from their album Preservation Act 1, 1973. My God, I was still in college when that came out. That's an appropriate setup for Nomi Prinz, whose book, Jacked, How Conservatives Are Picking Your Pocket, Whether You Voted for Them or Not, is just out from Polypoint Press. Welcome to Behind the News, Nomi.
Thanks a lot, Doug.
First of all, I'm curious why conservatives is in quotes in the subtitle.
Conservatives, as they think of themselves and as what they really are two completely different things. So while we have people running around Congress on the Republican side who think that they're fiscally conservative, in fact, they have created the biggest debt this country's ever had, the highest deficit, the worst trade imbalance, a really weak dollar, and really been completely fiscally non-conservative with any way of actually managing the budget. So I don't like to call them what they call themselves anymore.
So tell us how you wrote Jack. This is not a book you wrote sitting in your loft in the East 20s, is it?
No, I took a bunch of trips around the country. I started by getting Expedia.com on my computer at home and mapped out a bunch of routes around the country that took me to both red states and blue states and urban and rural areas, the middle of the country, the west, the north, and I basically wanted to get as much land covered and therefore as many different types of people spoken with as I could given a minimal amount of travel time. So for 4 months I basically was going around the country as airlines do and sort of dropping into places, renting a car, driving around a couple of states, talking to people, getting back to the plane and sort of going to the next region so I could keep it going. And I talked to people in the daytime, wrote up notes at night, and traveled very early in the morning or very late at night.
And, you know, if you watch Fox News, it's a country full of contented conservative people. Are Americans as content as some of the media would have us believe?
Yeah, now the media is kind of very glowy. I think that what was interesting to me, actually, one of the first places I stopped at was the Red South. Actually, I started in Florida, and I went through Alabama and Mississippi and Louisiana and down to New Orleans and stuff after Katrina. And what was interesting was even the people who had voted for Bush and made a point of telling me they had voted for Bush, they were really kind of concerned with how they were treated after Katrina, not just right after the hurricane when all the newspapers and shows were there and Fox.
Did they explain why they voted for Bush in the first place?
Because he's a good man. There was a little bit of a moral thing. There wasn't an economic reason that anyone could really think of that they voted for Bush. Mostly when people were very adamant about why they voted for him, it tended to be along the lines of religion or morality. And when I went to...
But he's mean, greedy, corrupt, and authoritarian. What's good about
Well, this is what I don't understand about the whole morality thing, because I kind of think it's immoral to take money from people. And one of the things this administration has done in a very grandiose way, in addition to running up a really, really insane amount of debt, is decide to cut everything that people actually need. So while the budget's about $2.8 trillion and our debt is $9 trillion, they go around and say, all right, well, why don't we make a few cuts here and there? And then they find higher education, and then they find Medicare, and then they find Medicaid, and they wind up slashing these programs that more people actually use and want and keep other stuff sort of fat. But what was interesting after Katrina was two things went on. I spoke with a number of people in New Orleans, and this one guy, Ozzie LaPorte, was a tour guide there. And after Katrina, obviously, he's got two big problems. One is that he has no one taking tours. And two is that he has these vans that he has to keep running so that even if one person is taking a tour, mostly to go into the disaster areas right after that and 6, 7, 8 months after that, he had to pay the gas to keep the vans running, whether there was one person in them or 20 people in them. So he was really noticing the fact that gas prices had really skyrocketed after that. And meanwhile, in Congress, we have a Senate hearing with a bunch of oil executives who have made scandalous amounts of money during that period of time and are telling Senator Ted Stevens, who's running this show, that we needed the money when they were asked why they were getting such exorbitant profits after Katrina. And their answer was, we need that money. And so I say this to Ozzie LaPorte. I'm like, what do you think of the fact that these people are going around saying they need the money? And he just said, which is a very kind of common type of comment that I got, I can't even think about how or why they're saying that. It's incredibly frustrating because I'll tell you what, I wish I had my own lobbyist, and I don't. So that was kind of more of what was going on.
Yeah, we all need the money, but not all of us can make our dreams come true, can we?
None of us can buy lobbyists or airtime.
Well, let's talk a bit about Katrina land. You've been there fairly recently. How much reconstruction is going on? Our president promised lots. Has he delivered?
Well, one of the places I spent the most time in was Mississippi of those four southern states, and that's primarily because most of the Mississippi inhabitants felt that they had been not talked about as much, and their issues hadn't been put as much forth in the media as in New Orleans, which was sort of the big point. It was as if they hadn't actually had the hurricane's eye hit them. And there was this one town, Waveland, which is almost on the border of Mississippi and Louisiana, that used to be a town of 7,000 people. And after Katrina, it became a town of 1,000 people. And right before the president gave his State of the Union address in the beginning of the year, he took a little tour through Mississippi to New Orleans. And I actually kind of followed him, but everything was a day later, so it was sort of to see what people actually thought. And the people in Waveland, the people that were left, made all these signs, and they're all thrilled he was coming by. And he didn't stop there. So the sort of joke in the town was that all we got was a wave in Waveland. But the houses were still certainly decimated at the time and months later. And I was back a couple months ago, and a lot of Mississippi and the coastline has been cleared at this point, but there's no rebuilding going on. And even people, again, who are staunch Republicans and Bush supporters, I talked to some of the casino owners of some of the casinos down there, and they really felt that there was a misplaced amount of money going, for example, to Iraq and, quote, reconstructing that region as opposed to reconstructing the Mississippi coast.
Well, a lot of money going to Iraq, but not a lot more destruction going on in construction there. But what about the private sector? We all know the government can't get anything done, but is the insurance industry stepping up to the plate?
Also there's a number of lawsuits going on against State Farm and Allstate and a number of different insurance companies down there who've decided that they're not going to pay out on a lot of the claims that are coming to them. There's a 4,000 family lawsuit that's being put together and worked on by Richard Dickey Scruggs, who was one of the famed lawyers who got the tobacco industry settlement a number of years ago on which the movie The Insider with Al Pacino was based. And he's fighting the insurance companies with a number of other lawyers. And it's not only are people involved in these suits, but the senator, Senator Trent Lott, whose home was leveled in Katrina in Pascagoula. It's just actually an empty lot, his lot. And he's also involved in the lawsuit.
So he's putting aside his bed sheet for the moment and siding with the good guys. For at least,
regulation
at least
works when you need the money.
Yeah. I'm speaking with Nomi Prinz, who's the author of Jacked, How Conservatives Are Picking Your Pocket, just out from PolyPoint Press. Well, you've got eight chapters in the book that detail some of the major areas of insecurity and instability for average Americans. So let's move on. And pensions. We used to have a fairly decent private pension system that's slowly disappearing, and of course a public pension system that's, well, some people would like to disappear that as well. What do you find out about the pension system?
Well, first of all, just to step back, the chapters in Jacked basically are the cards in your wallet. Or the cards in an average wallet. So they range from a driver's license, which kind of invokes our idea of where gas prices are and sort of that type, the crisis in oil, and credit cards and your employee ID, which is where I also examine the pension situation. And it's really the idea that everybody in America, whoever they voted for and whoever they are and whatever state they're in, has a wallet. And everybody has cards, and they actually all mean things to them on a daily basis in their regular lives. And then they also have implications in terms of how the government acts. So,
as Mark said, in a very different context, a man carries his bond with society in his pocket. So.
And it's true. And the wallet's actually, there's a ton of things you learn from talking to someone about their wallet. You know, everything, well, everything. Personal to financial, you get everything if you have a conversation with someone about how they use the stuff that's in their wallet. But on the pension side, that came up in my employee ID chapter. What I did was spend a lot of time in Detroit and Oklahoma City and outside Tennessee, were places where a lot of auto workers were getting shafted. I was in Detroit actually right before the Super Bowl. So you get in and it's kind of raining and gray and everything because it's Detroit and it's cold and there's all these like Super Bowl signs and the hotels that are operational are all full with people that'll just be there for those couple days and leave. And through that I went to the UAW headquarters and I talked to a lot of the retired and about to be retired auto workers about how things were and how things are. And they took me around and one thing that I noticed there, and one of the guys, Jerry Fisher, was this huge guy in like a size XXXX Super Bowl jacket, who was really sweet and talked about how he's been in three generations of auto, how he grew up in Pontiac, Michigan, how he worked in everything from Greyhound buses to trucks and everything, how it was phased out over the years, and how the workers really had suggestions as to how to be competitive, and they just weren't listened to. So as that was going on, and GM was losing its share, and they were looking where to cut money, and they wound up cutting them, as many companies did, from pensions and from health benefits. And Jerry was saying, you know, I had four kids growing up and my wife, and we had full plans on health, and I knew I was having a full pension, and I can't say that to my son. And another guy, David Dunn, out in Oklahoma City, who's a union leader there, was saying he's got two girls in high school, and he really just doesn't know where that's going to go at all, because he's just seen, as we have all had who work in corporate America, that the pension system just become completely eroded, and the idea that workers are now just hindrances to the profit of a company, and their needs are kind of in the way, as opposed to what used to be more in the 60s and 70s and early 80s, which was that they were valued.
Well, that was a day when the employers were somewhat afraid of the workers, and now the tables are turned. So it seems like the employers are lording it all over the workers, a one-sided class war being fought in the United States.
Well, the other thing, too, in the UIW is there's a statue out there which is just indicative of all of that, which is the builder, and it was around built around that time, and it was this very handsome, confident man with big biceps and kind of wavy statue hair, and he looked proud. And there's a difference when you're proud and when you can actually demand things with that sense of energy and sense of strength to how it turns around.
Yeah, I talked to a hedge fund guy some months ago who was he said, we don't even need an auto industry because, you know, our strength as Americans is designing stuff and financing it. And we can farm out all the dirty work to, you know, Chinese and Mexicans, but we don't need to build anything here because that's so old-fashioned and dirty. But that seems to be the consciousness of the upper levels of society these days.
Well, it was funny. I talked to one oil executive, actually. He was one of the only oil executives who would talk to me on record out in Houston, Texas, which is the oil capital of the country, and, well, next to Washington, I guess. But and he was saying that he felt as gas prices were up and oil prices were up and that industry was doing well, that actually that was the cornerstone of America and that was why the economy was going to continue to be strong and people were going to continue to drive and they were continuing to pay those prices and it was actually a positive. And then and I was at his house as we had this conversation, which is a very nice kind of immaculate neighborhood in Houston. And then his son walks in afterwards to talk to me, and his son is 30 and he works for one of the bigger construction companies in the country that builds, among other things, homes out in Nevada and other places. And he sits down, his father has left, and he kind of waits, and he whispers to me, I don't know what my father said to you, but I am so embarrassed. I live in a red state, and I don't think things are as good as my dad does, and I don't want to get into a fight with him right now, but I'm just telling you this. So what I did was I kept them separate, and now they're just both in the book in the same chapter together.
So now, but they know each other now. They know each other's secret thoughts now?
Now they know each other's secret thoughts. And everybody who buys the book will also know their secret thoughts.
The book being Jacked, How Conservatives Are Picking Your Pocket by Nomi Prinz, who we're talking with. The book just out from Poly Point Press. And another card, which actually a lot of people don't have in their wallets these days, is the health insurance card. What'd you find out about that?
Well, that's right. 47 million people don't have a health insurance card, and many of the ones that do find it really not insuring them to the extent that they would have liked or think or would feel comfortable with. But the health insurance chapter was, for me, one of the more interesting chapters and the hardest to pick the stories from all the people I had spoken with across the country, because everyone had issues with health insurance. And in this book, I wanted to show the similarities that we have throughout the country as well, no matter what our conditions. And so I picked ultimately five stories in that chapter. But I went out to Hollywood, and I talked to three very different people. A Hollywood ABC primetime producer who's doing exceptionally well, has tons of Emmys, and also happens to be a Canadian dual citizen. A former Laker turned actor whose health insurance comes through the Screen Actors Guild when he can find work. And a PR person who was actually a former meth addict and came back and is now trying to help lots of other people go through that situation, because that kind of addiction and coming through it is not covered by any insurance. But and then I spoke to a number of other people in the country. But what I found with health insurance is it's the least talked about demand in our polls, in, you know, what is covered in terms of pre-election stuff, in terms of, you know, post State of the Union addresses, but it's the thing that most people will point to as the second or third most important card in their wallet. Usually it's your driver's license and then your credit or cash card and then health, but it's the thing they will speak the most about and have the most fears about and have the most very bizarre stories about in terms of things that have happened where they have found themselves to be not covered, and that is when they are covered. So it's the thing that cuts across every single type of class, race, age in this country, and it is the thing that's least being brought up in Washington as any kind of actual solution to that issue.
Well, the things you're talking about now, these cards you're using as the organizing the metaphors of the book, are virtually universal. They're very serious. They affect people's day-to-day lives. They affect people's day-to-day lives in often very similar ways. Yet, there doesn't seem to be any crystallization of political understanding or agitation around it. So let's start by, how do the people you talk with understand the situation they're in? Do they feel that there's just their individual lot in life, or do they actually have some sort of political analysis?
That's a really interesting question, because I never started by asking them about their politics. I always started every conversation by asking about their wallets and going from there. And I let them take me into politics, and a lot of people didn't at all, didn't even go there, didn't make the connection. There was a very strong connection in the Gulf because of Katrina, and there was a strong sense that that was government's fault. There was the insurance companies not paying, and there were signs down there like, if you think Katrina was bad, you should meet my Allstate agent, spray painted on houses. But there, and there was a sense of government betrayal. With health insurance, there is not as direct a connection. Even I talk to military people who have decent health benefits but will tell me horror stories, and they won't come out and say, but therefore we need national health insurance, because there's this sort of distrust that that would be better. They have it. They have it, but they're seeing their benefits actually worsen at a slower rate, but in the same way as many people who had corporate health insurance. With credit cards, it was really interesting because no one made an assumption that anything, any issue that had to do with credit card or debt had anything to do with the government. And even with the credit card companies, people saw it as their own responsibility, even though credit card companies have the ability to jack up prices, jack up rates, put on late charges, and there's absolutely no rule as to what that number can be. And so even though people might amass their own debt for different reasons, they didn't see that as a connection or something that the government could stop. With oil prices, they blame the gas companies. That was very clear.
They do. But the credit cards are interesting because they're kind of our social safety net. We don't have much of a welfare state, so people use credit cards to keep afloat in hard times.
The credit cards, and again, people really see it as individual. Whenever I talked about credit cards, usually the first response was, well, I pay it off every month. What do you pay off every month? Well, I pay my minimum and a little bit more, but I don't have that much debt. And then when you start to actually talk about what that not much debt really is, it's for things like fixing your car or buying some of your groceries. Or, you know, I didn't come across those people who are supposedly using debt to buy Lexuses or plasma TVs, as the saying goes. I found a lot of people using it because they needed it, and not understanding that the rates that they were paying for it were grossly unfair. I mean, one thing I found out during the book was that the state laws, the usury laws that had been put in place to keep credit card and banks in check when they lent money, were actually based on the three major religions, and on the premise that you can't obscenely profit off someone else's misfortune. And that whole thing has gone out of the window with how nationalized credit card companies are, and how offshore they are, and on how they're all in these sort of neutral havens where they don't have to be under those types of rules.
But do people blame themselves for their situation?
In credit cards, there's a lot of blaming yourself. And when I do call-in shows, there's almost always someone will call in and say, well, it's their fault. You know, can't they just control their money? And don't we have individual responsibility? And yeah, we all have individual responsibility, but it's also a question of what we start with. I was talking to a guy at lunch today who does part-time filming, and he was liking it to, if you had one Michael Jordan on your team and you were against five other whoevers and you were down 30 points in the beginning of the game, you're starting at a real deficit. And that's kind of the situation, yet people blame themselves, even if they're the best at what they do and completely financially responsible. They're still starting out in many cases at that kind of a deficit.
Well, that's the genius of American political system, is that the elite can screw everyone else, and then everyone else will just blame themselves for the problem. Thanks for joining us, Naomi Prince. Naomi Prince, the author of Jacked, How Conservatives Are Picking Your Pocket, whether you voted for them or not, just out from Polypoint Books. And remember that the bitch reading at Blue Stockings tomorrow night, 7 p.m., Blue Stockings 172 Allen, between Stanton and Rivington, just a block south of Houston and First Avenue. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Stay tuned for the news. And let's go out with a piece of utterly frivolous weekend preparatory music by the Scissor Sisters. Till next week. Bye.